Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Okay, my pod this week is a man who has almost certainly moved your feet and made you feel the beat in a club at some point in your life. It's legendary producer, DJ, my man, label boss, Ashley Beadle. Now, Ashley was one of the early adapters back in the 80s, heyday of Acid House, and the man is still dropping tracks like the hot today, and he's awesome, man. We have a very cool conversation that goes all over the map, including why country music is so big in Jamaica. So check it out. First of all, I'm a big fan of your stuff. You know that.
Thank you so much.
And I always like.
And do you know what? I've got to stop you there quickly because I put a lot of people onto your show.
Oh, cool, man.
Because I love your show. And in return, all those people go, you played your edit.
See, the thing I think about guys like us, right? And you know, we're not, we don't know each other that well, but we know each other enough to know that we don't listen to one type of music. Or maybe we do. We listen to good music because there's two types of music, right?
Good or bad. Yeah.
Good and bad. But genre wise, it's never been genre specific to what I never said, well, that's funky or that's disco. I don't like it. Or that's heavy metal. I don't like it. It seemed like if there was something good in it, we could find the good and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, do you think that's a generational thing? Because I know a lot of new jacks that are kind of like, oh, I don't fuck with that kind of music because it's not my vibe. But I think it kind of limits you if you say things like that.
It's interesting you say that because I spoke with a very good friend of mine today, this morning on Facebook, Ross Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Ross was kicking off because he said, I hate The Fall. Never liked The Fall. I don't care if Marquis Smith's dead.
Yeah, he did pass away.
Yeah, not my thing. So I wrote back saying, steady, Ross, and a little laughter, you know. But he gave me a really big comment about, this is what I was into. Mm-hmm. Never loved The Fall, man.
Sorry. Well, I mean, a lot of music, especially in the UK, was really tribey, right?
In the
80s, it was, you know, people listened to this kind of music and they wore the clothes and it kind of defined them, you know? And I think as we got into the 90s and the 2000s, the music was so proliferated where everybody could listen to whatever they wanted. You know, it wasn't like the local record shop that you went to only had that kind of music. And I just think the way the radio was, it kind of, you could listen to all types of different stuff. And you listen to pop music now, they got 9-10 different genre influences in one song, you know?
Yeah, I know. Crazy. Yeah. It's really weird. I listened to a particular pop show the other day because one of my tracks is out now with Moose T.
Oh, yeah.
And we listened to the show because we heard, oh, they're playing it. It was on Radio 1. And I had to listen to the whole show until the second to last record. When they
it's always
it.
Like that.
And I was like, and I didn't understand any of the music. Yeah. I was really in shock.
Remember that movie Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone?
Yeah.
All right. Remember they were in the car with Sandra Bullock and they listened to the radio and it's like jingles for commercials? She goes, this is my favorite song because it's a commercial. She goes, no, because in the future, people are dumbed down to only being able to get like, you know, 30 seconds.
30 bits seconds.
And stuff, you know.
It was kind of a bit like that. There was a lot of talk.
Yeah.
But not a lot of music.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Music has been like, I think, incrementally moved to being a side salad rather than the steak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I remember when I was a kid, the burden would be on me. If I bought a record with my allowance and I didn't get it at first listen, I'd have to listen to it again. And the burden of the art was on me to enjoy myself through that. Not like, oh, swipe left or just, I'm not buying it. I'm just, you know, whatever they call it, downloading it or streaming. And that's people even download. They stream. They don't even want that shit anymore. It's crazy. But coming from a musical standpoint, I just want to kind of like, what got you into music kind of stuff? Like start at the beginning.
My mother's from Barbados.
Yeah.
And my dad was English. Mm-hmm. I was born in Hemel Hempstead, which is in Hertfordshire. But we never kind of stayed there. We went to Barbados when I was very young for a couple of years. Then we moved back to the UK. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up in northwest London in Harrow.
Okay, I know where that is. Yeah.
Harrow. Very big Harrow, and next door is Wembley and places like that. Quite a big black population. Mm-hmm. So my dad was all, most of my dad's friends via my mother were kind of black anyway, you know. So I was kind of introduced to a lot of that black music by my mother and father. And also my dad was a brilliant, I call him brilliant record collector.
Yeah.
And he collected everything. We used to have a greengrocer's directly opposite our house. And at the back of the greengrocer's, you'd go in the back of the greengrocer's and there was a record shop.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So you go, you walk through the fruit and veg.
And then there's the guy in the back on.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, with a like a wooden shelf.
That's
I can't even remember his name. It was amazing. 9 times out of 10, my dad would order his records from him. Or he'll buy stock what the guy would have in the shop, yeah. You know. So that we would. So 1 week you'd have ABBA, then the next week it'd be like the Guess Who, then the next week it'd be like Big Youth, and it was kind of a bit crazy with my dad, you know, because he didn't know what was coming into the house. But the first thing he'd do, he'd put it straight on the decks, and you
That's
know,
great.
He'd always hand me the sleeve.
Oh yeah, so have a look and see what's going on.
And I'd be looking on the back of the sleeve, and I'd see who produced it. And that was my thing for a very long time.
I loved Liner Notes as a kid, too.
Yeah.
I thought that was like, you know, my mom used to have a bunch of records. Not probably as cool as your dad's records, but, you know, like old Ray Charles records or Willie Colon records. And the thing I always used to pull was, I'd always pull the stats. Like, who produced this? Where they record this?
Same as me,
You know, and then every once in a while, like remember that Rolling Stones record, Black and Blue? They had the, what they call the track list from, from the two-inch tape.
Yeah.
And you could see who played on what track and how they bounced stuff together. I always found that fascinating. So I kind of understand what you were going through when you were seeing all this information. Now, did you play an instrument at any point?
Funny enough, no. I mean, I play, as of now, a bit of kit called machine. I mean, I like percussion, but I tend to do it electronically these days. But my dad's side of the family were very, very musical. In fact, his brother, Tony, who sadly passed away now, he had a group called Reflections, which consisted of all his family.
Oh, wow.
And they went on a program called Opportunity Knocks, a TV program in the UK, with a guy called Huey Green.
And what was that about?
That was just like a talent show.
Oh, really?
And they went on there. And they didn't get through to the final enough, but they were on the TV.
So this is the whole family just locked up. That's cool, though, man. You know,
but, you know, my cousin Jonathan, who's he's a little bit older than me, but he's like a virtuoso guitarist, incredible guitarist. And he plays with Cliff Richard and people like that. I kind of see Jonathan a lot of funerals, family funerals.
So unfortunately, the older we get, the more you see him, probably, you know? Yeah.
But we you know, we talk and that. I'm going to get him on a record, though, man. I'm going to get him on a record because he's... He's like Carlos Santana, man. He's in that league.
But a lot of those, I mean, he probably had to play every kind of music if he was a freshman cat, right? So did that, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is like, did you ever have a moment where you're like, oh, I like everything?
I used to listen to Capital Radio when it first started.
Yeah.
And there were two DJs on there. It was Peter Young. And he used to do like a very black influenced soul show, if I remember rightly, which I used to listen to late. You know, I should be in bed getting ready for school and all that. Yeah. But I listened to it late.
Yeah.
And the other guy was Little Nicky Horn.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Now, Little Nicky Horn, his shows were big, like 9 o'clock in the evening. And he'd be on the radio and he'd be like, right, we're flying over such and such in America and we're going to go and meet the boss, Bruce Springsteen. Wow. You know, and I'd be sitting there going, oh, my God, they're going to go meet the boss, you know. So that was kind of for me when I was about, I would say I was about 14, 15, I think my ears went, oomph, I'm into everything.
Yeah.
You know, that age.
I always think that enriches you kind of stuff. Because I grew up in a neighborhood that, like in the Lower Side of Manhattan, it was like you couldn't just like one thing because you'd hear everything coming out of people's cars, out of the houses and stuff. So
totally.
That kind of education for a musician and a producer, it puts you in the right frame of mind for when you get into stuff later in life because you have... I guess you have the language, right? And they're like, if someone's speaking Spanish, you kind of, and you know a little bit of Spanish, you know what's going on there. It makes your vocabulary a lot larger when you get in the studio.
One thing I would have loved to have ever talked was Spanish. My younger son, Joe, he's learning Spanish and Portuguese. Well, he can speak fluent Spanish now.
Yeah.
Because he can speak Spanish, he's been listening to loads of, you know, South American music.
Yeah,
and he speaks a bit of Portuguese as well. So he's been listening to a lot of Brazilian.
Yeah, word, and
he's been feeding me stuff on Facebook because he's over there at the moment.
Yeah. I guess, you look at what your kids are into. That I guess that was you being the dad that your dad was to them, right? They got them in all the different stuff.
Yeah.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, my older kid, Harry, he's really into loads of different things. And he sends me links up on Facebook as well. Mm-hmm. And he does his own stuff.
Oh, he's a producer as well.
Yeah, little producer, man.
Oh, that's cool, man.
He's got a little drum machine and Ableton and all that. And
yeah, so, a lot of people will talk about the different digital recording files. So what are you into? Ableton or Pro Tools?
I'm Logic, man.
You're a Logic man.
Yeah, I'm a Logic man.
I find a lot of British dudes got into Logic. Like, I know a lot of really good producers, but I mean, it's kind of the same thing as Pro Tools or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, you can take stems from one and put it in the other. So that's all that matters to me. Now, how did it come about that you became a producer? I mean, obviously, you were into music as a young guy.
It was one of those things where it's really funny. I used to have an old friend of mine called Eddie Jones. This was back in the early days of Rare Groove and getting into Acid House. And
so what's this, the early 90s, late 80s?
No, this was late 80s and that, you know. And we went and made a record. We put all our money in together and it was full of samples, you know. We went in the studio. Yeah.
Ain't nobody going to see you back then.
We went in the studio and we had this engineer and he did all the program for us. Oh. I think it was a guy called Danny Arno.
Yeah.
And I'll get further into him in a minute. He did a record called Psychic Vitamins.
I like the title, man.
I don't even own a copy. I think it's up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Very primitive. But then I think where I came into my own as a producer, where I thought, you know what, this is what we'll do, is when I bumped into the man, Norman Jay.
Yeah.
And we were in Cheapo Cheapo's, which is just down near Piccadilly. Yeah. It was a big old secondhand record shop. And I was looking for old disco records because I love disco.
Mm-hmm.
Purely because I was listening to Norman's show on Kiss. And I was up this ladder. Norman's up this ladder. And he's like, you need this. And I said, what is it? He says, it's a Tramps. With Where You Were, Tramps 4, I think, or something, Where Were You When the Lights Went Out.
Yeah, that's a track, man.
And I was like, okay. And he said, you need this record, Ash. So I got home and I was listening to it. And in those days, sampling was just about coming into the fore. You know, people taking certain chunks of tunes and all the rest of it. And I'm listening to this record and I'm thinking, yeah, if I could do that with that and that and that. And my man, who I was living with at the time, John, he went, well, yeah, why don't you go and book up Danny Arno, your friend, in the studio and take the record with you. And so I went with him and another guy, Rob Mello.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get into that later as well. And that was the first Black Science Orchestra record.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Where Were You? And we took the chunk of the Tramps and mixed it with acid. And
that's great, man.
Crazy bass lines. And
so it wasn't something that, like, you know, it was something that you did in your head and then went to the studio. And
just did it in my head. And then we went to the studio, we did it. And the record, Where Were You, it was really funny. It came out on Junior Boy's Own. And they said, you know, this is a mad record. We're going to put this record out. And it didn't really do anything. It just kind of sat there in the UK. And then guess who got hold of it? Frankie Knuckles.
Really?
Yeah.
Frank.
Now, Frankie, he got hold of the record. And all of a sudden, I'm hearing things back from New York from my friends going, Frankie's playing this tune he was actually. And I'm like, what tune's that? And they're going, I was thinking, I've only done one tune. I was like,
Where Were You? It's got to be that one,
right? He said, yeah. And I'm like, whoa. He's playing, oh, Where Were You? And so I actually went over to New York to, what was her name? Barbara House Singer. And she had a club called Cheetah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah, I know that. I used to hang at that club. Oh, man.
She had a club called Cheetah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm 20th or something
so
like
I'm
that.
Down there. I'm down there with Benji Candelario. And Benji's like, Frankie's playing tonight. You know that, don't you? And I went, wow, man. So Frankie was up on the decks. And I can't remember what his night was called. But anyway, he was playing Where Were You when I was there.
Wow.
And then when he kind of come off the decks for a bit for a rest, you know, Benji went, actually, come over here. So I went over there to Frankie Knuckles, you know, and he was like, we should meet each other. I went, hi, Frankie, glad to meet you. And thank you for playing my record. And he went, no, thank you for making it.
People, DJs forget that they don't make this fucking music. Other people do. That's crazy. See, that's an old school thing, right? So that's pretty much what got you on.
We became real close friends after that.
We'll be back after a message from our sponsor.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Back then, you go to see a DJ because they play something that you didn't know. You know, and I know you probably see this when you go out to clubs. People go up to the DJ and say, hey, can you play what I was just listening to in my car? Or you can play what I'm listening to in my headphones. It's like, wait, you go to get educated. I always thought like DJs would have stuff.
It's kind of weird now, man, because I stand there with the phones.
Yeah, and like this whole phones in my phones. I do DJ gigs. And I mean, it's pretty apparent I'm not one of these new jacks, right? I'm an old school dude.
Yeah.
I make a real plan that I'm going to play some Chaka Khan here tonight, you know, and be like, why don't you play? And I was like, because I'm trying to play something that you haven't heard. So maybe to open up your horizons a little bit. Some people get offended by that.
Yeah.
They're like, I don't want to hear this shit. It's like, well, I'm sorry that you're so closed-minded, motherfucker. But this is what's going to happen tonight. Yeah. Right? And like I do this block party thing and that kind of just branding it as a block party. Cause like, it was kind of selfish for me to do this. And I don't know if you, do you spin out every once in a while?
Yeah, I still DJ.
Yeah, all right, so, when you DJ, right? And I've kind of noticed this, but being the age I am and having kids and stuff, I go, all right, if I'm going to go out on a Friday night, that means I got to get a babysitter. All right, my wife has to, you know, it's a thing. We got to have to probably have dinner out. Then we're going to go out to a club and I don't want to show up there, have no vibe with some silly music,
yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff and young foolish people bugging out. So my idea was I'm just going to have a night that's got quality control, right? And it almost brings
absolutely,
it back.
Yeah.
But it brings it back to the old school vibe of you go somewhere to be taken care of.
Yes.
You know, you don't. I don't want the burden on the person who walks in going, shit, I got to go up to the DJ and tell him to play some good music. Like, that shouldn't be what your vibe should be. Your vibe should be hang out with your girl or your guy, relax, enjoy yourself. The music will be good. You'll be chilled. And I think that's one of the relationship between the DJs has changed. Like, Frankie Knuckles is one of the greats of all time, right? So get the fruit flies over you.
Yeah.
But one of the greats of all time that, I mean, obviously he understood who he was in the scheme of things. I think a lot of times DJs think that they make this.
Oh, he's a very humble man.
Oh, yeah. Well, humility is something that is in short supply lately, man.
So it was, you know, I was reading a very interesting story yesterday on Twitter. Someone had put a link up on Twitter. Everyone knows about Larry Levan.
Yeah. Right?
But this was quite interesting because it was like various people that either knew him or were very influenced by him.
Yeah.
But every single one of them spoke about his love and intensity about his music, but his humbleness as well and trying to get that music over. And, you know, with the whole Paradise Garage, that's what he did for a long time.
You know, people actually having pride in what they did, right? I mean, I guess with that comes a bit of humility because you know you can't do it all by yourself.
No.
I think, like, we esteem a little bit too easy nowadays when it comes to music, right? You know, I've kind of noticed like a lot of stuff is like the movies that we watch, right? They're all rehashes of some Marvel comic that, you know, it's already been written and it's really simplified and it's for under 20s and the Chinese market. So we're kind of like stuck as far as the music goes. I always think that with that kind of like, I call it the desert of pop music, that something good comes out of that.
Because
if you look at like in the 70s, you know, there was the punk rock came out and even like, I'd even say there was a lot of good house music that was coming out in the 70s because of the influence of disco. But then people were like, yeah, but you can take it over here. You know what I mean? Like the Chicago guys and all that kind of stuff. That was stuff I imagine you were listening to, right? It was coming up, right?
Yeah, well, we had an amazing shop. This is before I started working in record shops. And I was in a sound system called Shock Sound System. Mm-hmm. We used to play all over London and we used to do Notting Hill Carnival.
So explain to me, because I'm a New York guy, the Notting Hill Carnival. I used to live in Notting Hill and the sound systems are like dudes, like you, we'd have a PA system, right?
Yeah.
Like you'd have speakers and you'd roll up and take your show.
So we had the huge speakers and everything else.
I love that shit.
And we used to be right in Power Square.
Oh, yeah, I know where that
is. Right by the park there. That was our spot for Carnival.
All right.
But we used to go to a shop called My Price in Croydon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Jasper the Final Junkie and Jazzy M. Now, Jazzy M is, for me personally, is in the UK, you know, at a Godfather house.
Because
he was bringing that stuff over before I knew anybody. And my boys in Shock, Dean and Stanley, who kind of headed the sound system, they used to take us down there and we would buy up all the really early house records.
All right,
cool. And I'd be standing there going, what is this stuff? It sounds like reggae. To me, it sounded like ragamuffin, you know what I mean? And everyone, no, this is house, Ashley. This is house music. And that's how I kind of got into house, coming from a background of, with the sound system, it was funk, soul, reggae, rare groove, you know, that kind of vibe.
And but you did learn stuff. I mean, even like this, you got the Spanish influence that like Louis Vega and Kenny Dope brought to it as well. I mean, it was, I always thought it came from the Caribbean in one manner or shape, from being a Spanish Caribbean or you know, Black Caribbean. It always kind of bubbled from there. I remember talking, I think it might have been when I was talking to Horace Andy about what he was listening to when he was a kid. He said, we were listening to country western music.
That's right.
But the signal was so bad coming from America, we could sometimes only hear the upbeat. So that's why the upstroke thing happened. I was like, holy shit, for real? And like, you think about that, you know, that's amazing that that was how it was interpreted, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the chord structure is probably the same theory-wise.
It's pretty funny, yeah, because now you say that. It's very interesting because... Jamaicans love country and western. They love it. Yeah. They love a ballad. They love a death story. You know what I mean?
That's great.
That's kind of weird. Yeah, that's probably why, man. Because the signal was.
Yeah, I guess it must have been a little muddled over the waves and whatnot. I mean, but I think it was him that told me. I think it was when you were sitting there, we were talking about that record.
Yeah.
On that record, for instance, how did you guys get together? How did you get together with Horace? Horace got together
Horace,
with you.
I knew of him, obviously, for years and years of buying his records, reggae.
Yeah.
And I knew him, obviously, through Massive Attack.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was introduced to him once before by Daddy G from Massive Attack. Yeah. As an old friend.
Yeah, Grant's awesome.
Yeah, Grant is wicked. But I think he was asleep. They called him Sleepy.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody calls him Sleepy. Sleepy. He calls himself Sleepy.
And then it was years later that my friend of mine, Quinton Scott, from Strut Records.
Oh, okay, yeah, I know that.
Yeah. Quinton rang me up and he said, we're doing a new album project called Inspiration Information. I don't know how many of them are actually done, but he said to me, who would you like to work with? And I said, Gil Scott-Heron.
Yeah, well, why not, bro?
And unfortunately, I don't know what happened. I can't remember where Gil had passed or something. I can't remember.
Yeah, he wasn't well for the last.
He wasn't well.
Yeah.
He wasn't well. And then he said, well, we can't really do Gil. Who would you do? And I thought about it. So let me go away and think about it, you know. And then I was going through my records and everything else and looking around at stuff. And, you know, and I had a lot of, I'm a big reggae collector, you know.
Yeah.
And I love Horace Andy. And I said, I don't know Horace Andy. And I thought, let me try Horace. So I said, Horace Andy? And they were like, yeah, well, that's, we can do that. And I'm like, wow.
That's amazing.
And we had 11 days, but the budget only allowed for 11 days studio time.
Wow.
Which consisted of me going in for the day with Horace, building a track. He would then go home, write the lyrics, voice it in his head and come next day and voice it.
Wow.
And we did that whole thing in 11 days.
That's amazing. Because I listened to that record, I listened to it the other day after we spoke.
Yeah.
It has the sensibilities of a Horace Andy record, but then it has this like completely open platform. It's like an open, I mean, that you do the cover of the Stones record, Angie, and it's like, what the?
But he loved it.
I know, but it fits in perfect. I mean, I know that it was for him probably, he was probably stepping out of his comfort zone.
Yeah.
Right? Were you as well? I mean, dealing with him, but you said you're down at reggae.
It's funny, you know, because we and Horace had before we actually started the project, we had a lot of chats.
Yeah.
Loved his pop.
Yeah. Yeah, you that's, you know, as you listen to music on the radio, you listen to pop music.
Yeah,
you
loved his pop and stuff, you know. So it was kind of, the process of actually making the album with him was cool. Really straightforward.
So when I met you and him together, you guys seemed like you've been friends for like 25 years. Yeah. It was like, we were in the war together. We did a record together, man.
Yeah, you know? It was funny though, because when we took the album out on tour, we did like a mini tour over Europe and it. And it was quite funny, you know, when you're actually out on tour with someone, that's when the cracks begin to show. You know what I mean? Yeah. You start knitting each other. But it was cool.
You got to think, I mean, anytime I've been in a studio with somebody, right, you do get to know them on not just a personal level, but on a spiritual level.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you actually kind of, you conversate with, I guess, the better angels of their nature, right? Like if you're a creative musical guy.
It's funny, you know, because I had my, when I was a lot younger, I had my own kind of vibes with Rastafari, you know, growing up and that. So I was kind of immersed in that anyway. So me and Horace could talk on that level, you know, because he's, you know, he's a Rasta man and the rest of it. So that was very interesting.
Yeah.
So
I mean, meeting him, I saw him later. He played with Massive Attack recently in the summer in Bristol, two summers ago. And I was with Grant and Delge and all those guys. And They're like, there are horses here, man. I was like, and he goes, yeah, he'd love to see you. I was like, he doesn't talk about me. He's like, yeah, he does. I was like, what? And I walk in, he's like, hey, man. I was like, oh, I mean, it's one of those things where you're flattered, but you're also you're like, you know, he's one of those dudes where they say, like, you know, he's definitely one of my musical inspirations. Just the vibrato and the voice.
Oh, his beautiful voice.
Yeah, I mean, being in the studio with him must be just like looking at the engineer, like,
ooh, yeah, he's got an amazing voice, man. It touches you, you know, really does.
Now, I want to talk to you about the edit and what an edit is. Because a lot of times there's that record you put out with the Mavis thing. Love that. I play that as much as I can. Then you put out recently, I guess it's a soul edits, right? I mean, because you edited a version of Gimme Shelter, right? And I forget the artist, this lady who's singing it.
Ruth Copeland.
This thing, I played it on the radio. It's like 7 minutes long. I was like, you can't cut into this. So I just played it. I literally like, yo.
Well, the weird thing was, right, those edits I did was for the album Message in the Music. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of my last hurrah, if you like, doing edits, because I was kind of seeing what was happening on the scene. You know, now the edit scene is full blown.
Yeah.
Everything is edited.
But I mean, for someone who's listening right now, go, what the fuck are you guys talking about? What's the edit? I mean, because I see the thing, it's like a...
It was taking all the good elements of certain tracks. He can't edit everything, you know, he understands that. But good elements of certain tracks and increasing that, making it more, you know, you take a section.
Yeah, so do you have the individual tracks? Like
no, the, well, a lot of them, I was working off WAVs.
Yeah, okay.
On that particular album, the only track I had the actual parts
for. Multi-tracks
was the Heaven and Hell.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's the only parts.
Wow.
And I was bugged on that. So that's why the album took so long. Because I'd go in the studio and I was like with my man Darren Morris. Mm. And we were like sitting there and we were working out which tracks one they would allow us to edit because it was all legally licensed.
Yeah, that's true too. Right?
And it had to come from the Demon catalog because those are the guys that put it out.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of music.
They're a great label. They re-released our stuff, the criminal stuff. Good label.
Yeah.
Mike is cool.
So it was kind of, you know, picking certain tracks from there. Listening to the tracks, which I was doing with Ian Dewhurst, who was kind of the A&R for the project. And then once I listened to the track with Ian, we'd sit there and go, what do you reckon then? You know, we could take this section and da, da, da. And he'd be like, yeah, that'd be brilliant. And then, all right, that's in the bag.
Wow.
And I'd go in the studio, stick it in the Logic, and then we would literally cut it up, add keyboards.
Yeah.
You know,
add a little bit extra.
A little bit extra.
But you were putting drum tracks and bass tracks and obviously percussion, you know.
Yeah.
When you start,
I was doing a lot of that live as well.
Really?
Because once you've edited the track, you know, the track's not set at a certain BPM.
Yeah, that's true. This is before people,
I'm shifting, you know. It was like working with tape.
Yeah.
And I'll be sitting there and I'll be doing a whole live take of percussion over, say, one track. Or Darren would get his bass out to a whole live take.
Well, it brings it back to the days, right?
Yeah, and it was just shifting. Yeah. Lovely.
I guess when I first started recording music, right, with the Criminals, we would always put a click track down because we were working with samples.
Yes.
We'd quantize samples. So if it was something that was old, that wasn't on a click and it would kind of move around a little bit, we try to keep it from moving.
Yeah.
Then the more you get into music, you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The movement, being in front of the beat, behind the beat, all that kind of stuff makes the feel. You know what I'm saying?
Feel,
so instead of like making it really up and down, you got to let it move around a little bit. And when you play with more musicians, you're like, yeah, man, you got to be behind a beat here.
Yeah.
And you get up on front of the beat here. It's like, that's the nuance that I think is really important. When I listen to the stuff that you, like that last, the Message in the Music stuff, I mean, I can listen to that record all the time. That's probably, that's one of my desert island joints. Because it doesn't, it's continually giving you stuff. Obviously, there's the track that you know of, but then there's all the stuff underneath that you could see. There was a lot of brain power, like you were saying, going in there and doing all this stuff, man. And that shows. That's what I was like. You think of music as an onion. This is a real, an onion. It doesn't make you
cry. It was a joy to do. I mean, I still get asked to do edits. Mm-hmm. Problem being in their bootlegs.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I kind of made a thing after I did Message in the Music. I was like, you know what? If I do edits now, they're going to have to be
above board. Yeah,
you know. It got to be about the artist has got to get paid, man.
And what's the edit thing now? Are people just doing edits for edit's sake now?
Yeah, they're just doing edits for edit's sake, and the same tracks keep appearing.
Mm-hmm.
The same tracks keep popping up, you know, like the OJ's Message in the Music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dave Lee, Joe Negro, he took it for his Remix with Love 2 album,
mm-hmm.
I think it was, and he had all the multi-tracks, so he could do his own mix on it. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But most people, they're just getting it, and looping the first conga out
yeah.
for for like 8 minutes and then goes into the track.
Well, I mean, you see,
you know, and you're like, what's that about?
It's like that the new DJ kind of style where the dudes have you know, the Serato thing, and they can loop a whole bit of the song.
Yeah.
And that's cool-ish. I mean, I always like playing the original joints.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I can cut and beat match and all that kind of stuff if I need to. I guess in the immortal words of Frankie Knuckles, thank you for making that music. I'm going to play it as you made it. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to try to put four on the floor or something that doesn't have supposed to have it. But as you move on, I mean, in like music production, what are the things that are really exciting you as far as like technology that allows you to do your job easier? Because obviously you got the, like we were talking about vocabulary, you have that. You know what you're doing in a studio, but even like nowadays, I find stuff like you can, if I recorded a guitar track and there's a string that's out of tune on one of the guitars, like the G string's out, I could go in the computer and in a program and move the G string. So all this stuff kind of helps you. Also like amp simulators and drum simulators and synth simulators. They just save you time in doing what you're going to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing we love, we use them a lot within our productions is the plugin, the Abbey Road drums.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we got sets, 60s, 70s,
yeah.
You know, right. And they're great. And it's like, I'm feeling a bit, what's my man? Scott Walker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm feeling a bit Scott Walker, you know. Just get the 60s drums out, you know, and things like that. And then putting them through a massive reverb or something, you know, whole reverb or whatever.
There's a whole industry in plugins now. Like, I remember you'd have outboard gear. Like, I worked with this guy, Tim Latham, since we started our stuff, right? And he used to have this two big racks outboard gear that we'd ship places. Like, if we were recording in Hawaii, it would go out to Hawaii. Now, it's just, you got your laptop. But
you got your laptop, yeah.
The plugins are now licensed. Like, the Abbey Road thing is licensed by Abbey Road. So,
yes,
and
is,
also, because their name's on it, it's got to be a good plugin. It can't be like some bullshit plugin. Like, have you heard of Drumagog?
Yes.
Which is another great one. You can assign different drum sounds and have it find the pattern. And I always find that kind of stuff helps the process flow better. Do you think that's the case too? I get the Scott Walker drums and then we can move on to the next thing. You know?
I think if you're inherently musical, that's always going to shine you regardless of the equipment that you're using. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What will come out of the end product is good music.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, I remember...
I've heard a lot of bad music where people have got the most amazing plugins.
Exactly. I mean, there's a guy who will remain nameless, but he was like Madonna's front of house guy.
Right.
And the story goes, Madonna said, hey, just go out and buy the biggest, baddest Pro Tools rig you possibly can because I want you to record my live shit. So he did. And then he recorded all her live shit. And he was like, all right, so what do you want to do with this Pro Tools shit? He goes, well, I don't know. What the fuck, a computer? You keep it. So the dude has the biggest, baddest Pro Tools rig. And the story goes, for 150 pounds, you bring a computer to him and he'll just drop all the shit on your computer.
Wow.
Now, he's done this for like a whole bunch of people, right? And his story is, he goes, I'm still waiting for someone to put a fucking good song together with all the shit that I've given him. And I guess that's the paradox, right? If you, like you said, I mean, if you have an idea, if you're stuck with two-inch tape machines that you have to sync together, you'll get the job done. It might take you a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But I guess it always is a means to an end, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. But it's really funny. I was in with, I've just reformed with Rob Mello, the Black Science Orchestra.
Oh, cool. Oh, really? So you're going to be doing some stuff with that?
Yeah, new stuff. So you'll be hearing that. Don't you worry.
So, yeah.
And we just did our first remix for a Brooklyn label, Razor and Tape.
Yeah, I know Razor and Tape. Yeah, good label, man.
Yeah. So we just did a remix for them of this African track, which they found the parts for, licensed it, all good. And it was interesting. So I've gone up to Rob's studio, which is in Whitstable, which isn't far from where I live, on the train. And the way Rob works and the way I work at the other studio with my other man, Darren, and it was like, wow. And he had like a sequencer there,
yeah.
A Roland S770 sampler. You know, the big,
the big old
school sampler.
Yeah, like Hal.
Big old school sampler. And I'm looking at him and he was like, this is like the way I love to work, actually. And he had the big desk there and everything. But it was brilliant. It was like going back to the old days.
Yeah.
Watching him at work was fantastic.
I know that, like my partner Fast, who I work with a lot, he does a lot of the programming, the sequencing. And we started with an Ensoniq, it was an Ensoniq keyboard, right?
Wow.
That had an 8-track sequencer. And Ensoniq used to make hearing aids. And then someone who worked at the company was like, we can also make samplers or whatever. Because it was not like a big part of their revenue stream, but they made these little things. And I remember we did like the first couple records on this little bullshit 8-track sequencer. It was really not, the sample rate was like 4.
You know? Yeah.
It was just completely horrible. It sounded rough. But, you know, you got what you wanted out of it. I know that even to this day, I bet you Fast still wishes he could still fuck with that old school keyboard. Because I guess the first time you get into something, that's where you feel most comfortable. And you see guys with old rigs and things like that. And
yeah, we still got an Akai.
Yeah.
Which we used. We actually went to use it the other day and it didn't work.
Fucking typical, man.
In the disc. Because the disc is brilliant. On the disc was written hip hop loops. I'm like,
that should be great. Yeah,
that should be great. Put it in and nothing worked. And we were like, oh, man.
It's like new hip hop doesn't work, man. So I did want to kind of ask you a couple more questions about, well, we're talking about what you're doing next, right? So that's.
We're doing Black Science. Mm-hmm. I'm working also with an amazing singer called Waterson.
Mm-hmm.
I've just finished his album.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to send me some
stuff. Yeah, I'll send you some stuff, yeah. So we just finished the album. So we're just waiting on, I think, it's in the hands of my manager now, Adam, but we're just waiting on label release on that. Mm-hmm.
What's the feel on this guy?
Got a lot of really strong influences. It's very electronic pop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the feel of it. Cool. He comes from a very house vibe, but it's very electronic pop. It's a beautiful vibe to it.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it. I mean,
he knows his shit anyway, which is good.
A lot of the new guys that are coming up who know what they're doing really understand what happened before them, right?
Yeah.
And like, I guess those are the guys that you end up working with that know what they're doing. Are there any guys that you've heard, like we were talking about you listening to radio, having to listen to Radio 1 the other day to hear your joint, but is there stuff that you have heard on the radio lately that you're kind of like, they seem like they might be okay? Because I have this problem, and I might be because I'm a grumpy old man now, but like when it comes to hip hop, I'm just like, I don't feel any of these things.
I don't. Yeah. I don't listen to it. I really don't
listen to it. I thought I was crazy, but thanks. No, really, I'm not fucking crazy. All
no, right. There's a lot of us out there who come from that era of hip hop, which I call hip hop.
Yeah.
I call it hip hop, you know? What I make now,
Gucci
I
wouldn't even call it.
I just not even rap.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't get it. It's for the kids, man. It's their thing now.
And you know, you're right. And I kind of don't feel bad for them.
No.
It's theirs to deal with.
We were in the studio the other day to get some inspiration, you know, and we listened to Main Source looking at the front door.
Wow, what a joint, yeah.
And it was just like
boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, and we were listening to it, and you know, the drums, and straight away my missus was there in the studio with me, and she went, play that again. And then she went straight onto YouTube and played Gladys Knight in a Pips version of Who Is He Is What Is You To You. That's where he got the drum from.
Damn.
And I was like, wow.
Your wife's got perfect pitch.
Yeah, she has. Damn. And I was like, wow. I never knew that's where he got the drums from. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's Donald Byrd, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The drums
and
all the rest of it, you know. And but we listened to that and I kind of closed my eyes for a second and I just got warm.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, this guy, man, Large Professor.
Yeah, one of the best, man.
One of the best.
I was checking something. I was talking to someone about some New York show that I was trying to put together. It wasn't a New York block party, but it was like a New York kind of radio show we might be doing. And they were talking about like, you know, what talking head shit. And I said, you know what? I remember I haven't watched Stop Making Sense in maybe like 20 years, right?
No, I haven't. I haven't even seen the movie.
It's fucking crazy. So I go back on YouTube. I just press play on the thing. And then you see like the feet of David Byrne walk out, puts a boombox down, presses play.
Yeah.
It's an open stage. You know, the whole idea before thing. And he starts doing Psycho Killer. And by the end of it, it's like a full-on soul gig going crazy. Bernie Worrell on the keys.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's bugging out with his face. Like, and all those crazy, if you listen to the, I guess, you know, Burning Down the House with the and all that crazy keyboard stuff, that's Bernie Worrell.
Bernie Worrell,
just kind of tweaking out. And I realized that the Talking Heads were so much better than I thought they were. You know, because you love their music, but you're thinking, holy shit, these guys would go out on stage. And this is before backing tracks and clicks and all this kind of stuff. And they were
one of the tightest bands, man. Serious tight band. You know, they kind of morphed into this amazing funk band.
That came from, I guess, a lot of that New York era in the 70s. Because it was funny because I was trying to explain how all these dudes were coming up at the same time. And I was like, well, they were all hanging out in the same neighborhood below 14th Street.
CBGBs.
Yeah. They're all going to clubs down there.
Yeah.
So they're all buying drugs from the same guys.
Yeah.
They're all doing the same kind of drugs. And New York wasn't ever like a really cool, happy scene. It was always like fucking crazy people. But then you saw all these kind of like amazing things happen. And then that turned into like, you know, what hip hop became. You know, that was, because I remember punk rock happened happened in the UK probably bigger than it happened in America. But at the same time, hip-hop was going on. And that's when you see, I remember The Clash coming to New York and doing that shit at Bonds and having Grandmaster Flash open up.
Seven Nights at Bonds,
man. I mean, I was like, I don't know, I must have been like 11, 12 years old, trying to get in.
Wow.
Like trying to scam my way in. I don't know how my mother let me out of the house, but, you know, I must have told her some bullshit. But I don't see that happening so much now where...
Well, everything's co-opted, isn't it? Now? Everything's kind of can be shrunk onto YouTube or the internet now.
Yeah.
There's no...
And also when you mix stuff, and I find this like with old school cats like yourself, I'll listen to your stuff on proper headphones, on a proper stereo, and I'm gratified. You know what I mean?
Oh, bless.
But a lot of times you listen to some of this new stuff and they don't mix it for nice speakers or nice headphones. They mix it for MP3.
MP3, which
is like pretty much binary code squashed down.
I can't stand it, man.
But I always say with the ebb and flow, I'm sure that it's going to get better.
Yeah.
And I'm always hopeful with the future when it comes to music. So
there's still some great bands coming through. Mm-hmm. You know, I listen to Six Music all the time.
Yeah.
You know, me and Joe, we listen to Six Music all the time. And she has got a very open mind as well, you know. And she's like, wow, you know, come and listen to this. You know, and there'd be something new. Mm-hmm. And she'll, who's this? And I'll be like, I don't know. And then we're like,
well, dude,
wait for the DJ to say.
Yeah. Well, the thing about good partners is they're always pushing you in the right direction.
Yeah.
My wife used to run Full Cycle Records back in the day. So it was all drum and bass out of Bristol.
Oh.
Yeah. So she was the MD of that label. And that wasn't my thing.
All praises to your wife, man.
Yeah, no, she's awesome. And I remember that wasn't my vibe. And then I started listening to the music that she was listening to and then got it. Like, it clicked. I was like, oh, shit, this Ronnie Size guy and Crust and Die. These guys are next level.
Yeah.
But you had to kind of immerse yourself in it. And there was always levels to it. So I'm like I said, it's great always hanging with someone like you talking about music, man.
Yeah. No, absolutely, man. Absolutely.
So aside from this new cat, you got the other thing happening as well, right?
We've got a Black Science Orchestra. Mm-hmm. We've sent a demo over to Waterson to do a vocal to for a new Black Science track. On top of that, I've got the North Street Studio One thing.
Okay.
Now that is myself, Joe, and Darren Morris as a remix production collective.
That's cool.
And we do a lot of remix for Joe's label, Ramrock, which is doing really well at the moment. Darren does his own stuff as well. He's got loads of different projects that he does. Just weird and wonderful projects as well, which I really like.
Your music is a multifaceted, it's like a hydra, you know.
That's how we always like it, man. It's like I think we could probably take a leaf out from Parliament Funkadelic.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing where they had all the different strands.
Yeah, indeed. Well, dude, thank you for spending a couple of minutes here with me, Ashley. You're awesome, dude.
Thank you.
Follow Ashley on social media and Facebook, obviously.
Facebook, yeah. Yeah, you can follow me on Ashley Beadle, Hallam Ashley Beadle on Facebook. I'm the Ashley Beadle up on Twitter.
Absolutely. I follow you on Twitter, man. It's always good. You always drop some science, man. Well, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you taking
Bless
time.
You, man.
Right on, dude.
And that was Ashley Beadle. He's a very cool man. I hope you enjoyed listening to that episode as much as I enjoyed recording it with him. I did that at the Edition Hotel in London. They're really nice people there. They let me kind of post up there and do a lot of my pods from there. I really throw them a lot of love. So you know what to do. Rate, review, and subscribe to the pod. Thank you very much. And until next we meet, y'all stay classic.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.